Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Connolly, Judge Frisch, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals panel for July 21 of 2022. We have two cases on our oral calendar today and three non-oral. Our first oral case is being heard by Zoom. And the next one will be live. The first matter on our calendar this morning is State of Minnesota versus Charlo. Council, please do state your argument, because even though we can see each other in the video, we are only capturing this by audio for the public presentation that we archive. So do state your name as you begin each leg of your argument. Be mindful of the timing restrictions. Each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that time for a rebuttal. And also, I'm assuming we're not going to have any technological glitches, but if we do, if you happen to have difficulty hearing any of the judges or opposing counsel, or you see a video freeze up, just bring it to our attention somehow and we'll try to pause the proceedings and let the technology catch up to us. We'll try to keep on track this morning because we have to leave the Zoom calendar and go into the courtroom. So be mindful of the timing restrictions as you are engaging in your argument. With that, appellant's counsel, whenever you are ready to proceed, you have the floor.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll just note that, Your Honor, some of the audio is cutting out a little bit for me. So I just want to make sure that we are aware of that.
Well, before you go further, is it just others have the same problem, if it's on my end or if it's on your end?
I don't know. You just cut out for me, and it sounded like somebody was speaking over you, and then it rushed up. So I'm not sure what the issue is there. Okay. I am at my office. We have excellent internet here, so I don't know that it's on my end. But
all right.
Okay.
All right. If you have any issues with any hearing, just flag. We can pause the proceedings and make sure that you hear every word.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. And thank you for allowing us to appear by Zoom today. May it please the court, my name is Jennifer Workman. I'm an assistant public defender, and I represent Preston Charlo, who's the appellant. Your Honors, this case centers around the search warrant for Isabel Braveheart's house. Today, I'd like to focus on the no-knock warrant and the probable cause issues. But first, I want to be very clear from the outset about what information the police supplied in the search warrant application and what information the district court had at its disposal for its omnibus ruling. It's important to know the correct facts here, because ultimately those facts show that the warrant was deficient in this case. Now, in the warrant application, the police averred facts about the missing victim, including that he had been in an altercation earlier in the evening before he went missing, and that altercation occurred at a bar. The last line of the application said that police sought the warrant in order to find the missing person or to, quote unquote, disprove or prove that he was the victim of a crime. The district court, in its omnibus ruling, relied upon documents attached to the defense's motion to suppress. Those documents were the Minneapolis police records, the search warrant and application, and the CLEAR report run by defense counsel. The district court did not have the Bloomington police records or the voluminous police records that were provided in the stipulated facts trial. The court mischaracterized the argument at the bar as an assault or a serious fight. And the court used this mischaracterization to justify the no-knock warrant and to find sufficient probable cause. But nothing—
Can I just ask a couple of factual questions about that particular aspect of the allegation and the warrant?
Yes.
Because when I review the record, it wasn't clear to me. So I'll just be frank. I'm very concerned about some of the misrepresentations of material fact that I see in the warrant. And the allegation that the victim was engaged in a fight with CJ and Miss Braveheart was present during that altercation, I didn't see anywhere in the record indicating that Miss Braveheart was actually present at that altercation.
That's my understanding as well. I think the Minneapolis police records indicate from the witness interviews that she knew the people who were at the bar that evening, but she may not have been present. It's unclear whether she was actually present at the bar that evening.
It seemed like it was a person named Katrina that might have been present at that altercation.
I don't know if Katrina was present, but Katrina knew the victim, and she was also a person who was interviewed by the Minneapolis police. Yes.
All right. And then just to be clear, the person that the victim had the altercation with, that's not Mr. Charlotte. That's somebody different.
That is a person who is unrelated to this case altogether.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification.
Yes. So, yes, Your Honor. The court's erroneous.
No, I apologize, Ms. Workman, but if we're on facts, just to clarify me, do you agree that the evidence did suggest that Ms. Braveheart did drive the victim to the residence she was staying at? Would that be a fair statement?
She did not drive the victim there. That was done by Kendall Parks, who is a witness. And Kendall Parks drove Mr. Albrecht, the victim, to her home. And that is, she was
so
not
she didn't drive him, but they did drive. The person you just identified did drive him to Braveheart's residence where your client was also living. Was that a fair statement?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Yes. Once the correct facts are understood here, Your Honors, it's obvious that this warrant was nothing more than a fishing expedition. The warrant insinuated that something must have happened to the victim at the house, but it failed to connect a criminal act to the house.
We've got a human being that vanishes, and the circumstances, the location, the timing, all point to a specific house.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is the district court required to assume that he was abducted by aliens, or isn't it inferred? Let me go back a minute. So you've got the facts that suggest there is a drug related disagreement shortly beforehand at a bar, that the victim ends up at this house, that at some point contemporaneous with the victim being at the house, all communication ends from the victim. The phone is no longer in use. And as far as anyone can tell, that is the time period when whatever vanishing, whatever happens, happens. So other than a crime, let's assume that there might be something other than a crime. Does the fact that there might be some other justification, some other rationale to explain his disappearance necessarily invalidate the plausibility or the probability that a crime also may exist? In other words, there could be multiple probable bases, but are you suggesting that crime having occurred, whether it's kidnapping or some form of homicide, is implausible?
Your Honor, what I'm suggesting here is that we have to follow the very clear standard from Illinois v. Gates on, from our case law, from the U.S. Supreme Court case law, and that is that there is a fair probability to believe that contraband or evidence of the crime will be found at the place to be searched, which is the home in this case. Now, when you look at the district court's ruling on this, you will find that the district court found that the combination of facts that Your Honor just recited would establish probable cause, and this is a direct quote from the district court's ruling, that the victim or information about the victim's whereabouts can be found in the place to be searched. But we're not looking for information here. It's clear that you have to look for evidence of a crime. It can't be a generalized search. Generalized warrants are not allowed. We have to follow.
Are you suggesting that there has to be an actual crime specified? If the fact suggests a couple of crimes are plausible?
I'm not going to say that a crime has to be specified, although the Berger versus U.S. case from the U.S. Supreme Court says a specified crime Our case law does not say that. However, there does need to be evidence of an alleged crime, and there was no crime alleged in this warrant application. It could have been that he had gone missing and decided to disappear on his own because he was worried about these people who he was involved in an argument over drugs with. There are many other plausible notions here.
That gets to my question. The fact that there are other plausible probabilities doesn't rule out the constitutionality of a search based upon probability of a crime, if that's also a probability. I'm just curious as to whether you believe it's implausible under these facts that, or it's even probable that—
Under these facts, we need more information that there was a crime before going into that house. And the facts that were averred by police in that application were deficient. There is nothing about a crime that occurred there. Now, you know, that raises the question, well, what should police have done? They could have done more investigation before getting this application. First and foremost, they could have surveilled my client and his brother. And if they had done so, that might have been very fruitful for them because they were alleged to have gone back to the site where the body was buried and to have sprinkled borax on the body. If they had been surveilling them and following them during that time, they would have been able to discover the body, and that would have given them probable cause for sure. If they also could have just gone to the house, knocked on the door, and interviewed whoever answered the door. Furthermore, they could have
So they didn't do that. So can we just turn to the no-knock provision, the unannounced entry? So assuming that we find that there's, you know, probable cause on this warrant, however thin that may be, that there's some connection between this residence and the disappearance of the victim, tell me why there's not enough there to assume that this potential victim is in peril if he has been missing for 3 days by the time the warrant is executed.
Well, we have to remember that probable cause and no knocks are divorced from each other.
Correct. And I mean, what's the reasonable articulable suspicion to suspect that this person is in peril?
So, Your Honor, there were two reasons that were forwarded by the police in the warrant application to justify the no-knock provision. The first was that it was necessary to prevent the loss or destruction of the evidence, which is frankly laughable in this case, because this is the type of evidence that cannot be destroyed in the 15 to 20 seconds that it would take for officers to enter into a home. The second reason is that the conviction history posed a danger to police. But when you look at Mr. Charlo's actual conviction history, that shows that he poses a danger to intimate partners, perhaps, but not to police or the general public. And when you're looking at this, that misrepresentation is reckless. And the reason it's reckless is because the only thing that is presented to the district, to the court there, is the misrepresented conviction history. There's nothing that it's not, here's some of his correct conviction history, and here's some misrepresented parts that the district court could parse through. It is only misrepresented in the application. And because of that, of course, the district court was reviewing this would think, oh my goodness, this is a person who does pose a threat to police. Of course, that had to have had a big impact on the district court's decision to issue the no-knock warrant in this case.
Can I ask you a big picture question on this issue that Judge Frisch brought up, you know, the no-knock issue? I was surprised that neither you nor the state cited Hudson v. Michigan or State v. Jackson. So Hudson v. Michigan is the United States Supreme Court case where analyzing the federal constitution concludes that resort to the massive remedy of suppressing evidence of guilt is unjustified. So in that case, you had a constitutional violation, a no-knock violation, and the Supreme Court says, okay, it's a violation, but that doesn't mean you necessarily get the evidence suppressed. And then you have State v. Jackson, which in the Minnesota Supreme Court says, we don't reach the question of whether the Minnesota Constitution is interpreted more broadly so that suppression results in the face of Hudson v. Jackson. So what's your position? Why would we hold, even if you're correct that there was a violation of the no-knock requirement, that suppression of evidence is the remedy?
Well, Your Honor, when you look at Garza and Botello, and I think Garza especially goes through this, the exclusionary rule has been found, the limitations upon the exclusionary rule, I should say, that have been found in federal case law. In Minnesota, we have declined to adopt that same limitation. And Garza talks about if this is a reckless misrepresentation, we're not going to get into that limitation on the exclusionary rule. We think that police should act properly and that we should hold their feet to the fire. So I would point Your Honor to the Garza decision. I would point you to Botello, Anderson as well. The case law is clear that when it comes to exclusionary rule, this is the right thing to do for a no-knock provision. It is a fundamental violation of people's rights to bust into their home when you don't have the proper provisions to do so.
Counsel, can I just return to my question? Because I appreciate the characterization of the information that's contained in the warrant that has later been proven to be a material misrepresentation about the criminal history of Mr. Charlo. But my question was a little bit of a finer point, and that is, we're dealing with somebody who is alleged to have disappeared, is the last place that he has seen, has been seen, is this house. Isn't there enough to piece together from this warrant the assumption that he could be in peril such that the unannounced entry is necessary? I mean, that's what the district court found. So, I mean, taking out the criminal history there, is there enough in this warrant?
Well, I would say first, that would be the district court going away from the two reasons that were proffered by the police. And so we're essentially getting away from what the police thought they could go get into, why the police thought they could get a no-knock warrant. And I'll also just point out that the language of this no-knock warrant is clearly boilerplate language, that and the same typos show up in this language in other Hennepin County cases, specifically the Harrell case that we cited in the brief. And so it's obvious that
By the way, I didn't check. Was the Harrell case, we know it was in Hennepin County, was it the same officer or was it not related to this officer?
I don't believe it's the same officer, Your Honor, but I don't know that they named the officer in Harrell.
Sorry, I interrupted your answer. I want to make sure you
that's okay.
Thank you. Question.
Thank you, Your Honor. So going back to your point, Judge Frisch, about the no knock, when you get in, I think that was when you see the district court's ruling about the victim being in peril, I think that is the district court applying a probable cause sort of standard to a no-knock provision. And we have to remember that those two are divorced. They are not the same thing.
But it's a reasonable suspicion standard for no-knock,
that's right?
Which is less than PC.
It is, but my point here is that the court was using those facts to from its earlier probable cause analysis to sort of bootstrap this argument along to it.
Right. Ms. Workman, so for the no-knock, it's reasonable suspicion based on reasonable inferences. Was that a fair statement?
Yes, yes. It's reasonable suspicion based on reasonable inferences, yes.
So aside from whether this affidavit is great or not, if you believe, because most of the case law that deals with no-knocks seems to deal with officer safety and, imminent destruction of evidence. But let me ask you this. If the police believe someone has been kidnapped and that person is in a particular residence, would you agree, and assuming that, you know, that's all correctly laid out in an affidavit, would you agree that that in of itself, i.e., you know, the possible danger to the person who's been kidnapped, would be a sufficient basis for a no-knock?
I think we need to have more facts articulated as to why that person is in danger before we can give a no-knock.
Well, and I mean, common sense would suggest that if someone's been kidnapped, they're in danger. I mean, I, speaking for myself and not my treasured colleagues, I'm not going to assume that kidnappers, you know, well, we kidnap, but we don't kill. That's where we draw the line. So for me, and I didn't see the cases, but So you think it would not just be kidnapped slash missing, but there'd have to be some suggestion that, well, you know, they're not going to pay the ransom, so they are going to kill him. So you think it's something more than just he or she is kidnapped and is at the space for a no knock?
Yes, Your Honor. There needs to be particularized facts about why 15 to 20 seconds cannot be waited and why they're at such peril that seconds matter in this case.
But I mean, you know, someone's throat could be slit in 15 seconds. Would you agree with me?
That's possible, Your Honor, but we don't have those facts here.
Thank you very much, Ms. Workman.
Yes.
Thank you. I don't believe there's any further questions from the panel, but you will have 5 additional minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Counsel for the state.
May it please the court, counsel John Schmidt, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney on behalf of the state of Minnesota. There's no disputing here that Charlo and his brother lured W.A. to a house, brutally beat him by kicking him, punching him, slamming his head into the ground until W.A.
Can I pause you there? I didn't want to interrupt you too quickly, but I understand getting to the ultimate facts after the search warrant might be helpful, but can we stick to the, maybe focus on the issue that we've got and the facts that support the search warrant and the no knock?
Right, and that's where I was going to conclude, that after all the police investigation brought this about, the only question before the court is the validity of the police investigation, specifically the warrant to search the house. Now, a couple of clarifications. Number one, it's been stated a couple of times that in the warrant there were material misrepresentations. The district court never actually made that finding. That's a two-part Frank's prong test.
Well, Mr. Schmidt, I mean, I mean, one of the reasons that you're claiming that the no-knock warrant is valid is because Mr. Charlo has an extensive criminal history of crimes of violence, and the record here demonstrates that he does not. He has one DWI conviction, 2 violations of an order for protection, and 1 no contact order violation, or the other way around. And none of those are crimes of violence under Minnesota law. And the district court made a finding that he's been convicted of crimes of violence and also resisting arrest, and that's not true.
The record on the Franks prong, I agree there's incorrect information in the warrant. I don't dispute that. But the Franks prong is whether the officer made these misrepresentations deliberately or recklessly. And that finding has never been made. In fact, in a footnote, the district court said that was not a deliberate or reckless or material misrepresentation. And so to the extent that this court wants to find that the first Frank's prong about material misrepresentations being deliberately or recklessly made, a remand is required.
Let's assume they weren't material or weren't maliciously made. You've got a very specific 4 corners of the application issue, it seems to me, where the affiant says that there are 2 bases for the no-knock. Interesting. What doesn't show up here is any concern about the victim, about the missing person. The basis for the no-knock is potential harm during the execution to the public or destruction of evidence. So my question for you is, are we or are we not limited in both the Fourth Amendment analysis of probable cause and the no-knock basis for the no-knock? Are we not limited to what is in the 4 corners of the application?
Well, first, the 4 corners argument that appellant made here is about probable cause. The no-knock was not made within the 4 corners. The no-knock argument was made after the Franks analysis. So we're assuming then that, and that's what the district court did here. The district court removed the incorrect information and then said that the no-knock was authorized. So I want to make sure those 2 things are not conflated.
No, I think what you do is you remove the incorrect information and you ask, is there enough? Don't you still look at the 4 corners of the document or not?
The way that these arguments have been presented is, number one, 4 corners of the document without a Franks analysis. Number two, after the Franks analysis with all the testimony that came in to verify different things. So you look at the transcripts and the evidence presented at the Franks hearing, and then do a separate analysis of probable cause and reasonable articular suspicion. So that's the way these arguments have been raised here. So I don't think that the no knock is part of the four corners argument.
Okay, let me ask you a question about convictions versus action. So the Supreme Court says you're going into the home where there is a person who's engaged in violent crimes before. Do you need a conviction for the officers to have a legitimate no-knock concern, a safety concern? Do the crimes have to, of violence have to be result in convictions to support a no-knock?
I don't believe so, because some things can get resolved in a plea agreement, correct? So you may plead guilty to a lesser crime, and you may have allegations and police reports that verify information. Now, as to the reasonable articular suspicion for the victim in particular, the court in the warrant said that the no-knock is appropriate, one, for evidence, two, to protect the searchers, or three, or the public, to protect the safety of the public. Now, that's where we have the victim. And that the victim here is a public. I mean, they could have said to protect the safety of the victim. That would have been
where does it say that in the warrant, Mr. Schmidt? An unannounced entry is necessary to prevent the destruction of evidence or to protect the safety of the searches. Oh, okay, or the public, because okay. I see it.
Correct. Yeah. On I'm looking at the addendum on page 6, the searchers or the public.
Yeah.
And that's the search warrant. And so that's where we get to the victim here, where that analysis of the victim being in peril, the victim being kidnapped, that's where that becomes relevant.
Then the stated reason in the application is the reason that we need to protect the public is, quote, because Mr. Charlot has previous convictions for felony assault of a police officer.
Well, I think that is in, yep, that's in the warrant itself. I was looking at the warrant itself is actually on A6 of the addendum, and that's where Judge Moore signed it.
Yes, but the application, the stated reason for needing a for needing an unannounced entry is because of these previous convictions, plural, for felony assault on a police officer.
An unannounced entry is necessary to prevent the loss, destruction, or removal of objects, or to protect the safety of the searchers or the public because he has previous convictions. Right. So you delete the for felony assault of a police officer.
And so then there's that. No other because, right?
No, because the resident has previous convictions. And so what we're looking at here is a missing person who, by all accounts in the rest of the warrant application, says that he completely disappeared after being dropped off at the house of Braveheart, after just having an altercation, an argument with a known drug dealer about a drug debt who is also associated with Braveheart. And after he got dropped off at this house, zero contact. His cell phone doesn't show up for work. They investigated this. They investigated that this is Braveheart's house and found that this person is at this house. And because he has prior felonies, he may be in danger.
So prior felonies of any kind can justify a no-knock entry? I mean, he's got a prior felony for a DWI and violations of no contact orders, which are not crimes of violence in the state of Minnesota. Lots of people sure. have all kinds of felony convictions, identity theft. Are we saying that now no knock warrants are allowed for people with anybody who has a felony conviction?
But at least for purposes of what the warrant authorized the police to do, of what the judge signed, there is no because in that sentence. It's about protecting the safety of the officer or public. And
let me ask a different question, Mr. Schmidt. What is the reasonable basis to conclude that 3 or 4 days after the last sighting of the victim, that there's some emergency to go into this house because of the victim might be in peril? What's the connection there in the warrant? I mean, because we have a time lapse here.
There is a time lapse. I don't recall that it's 4 days. I think it's shorter than that. I think from the date he disappears, which is overnight, until the date that they execute the warrant was...
Last seen November 15th at 4 a.m. The warrant's executed November 19th. Okay. So what about November 19th? What about that is an emergency to go in the house without knocking and announcing?
Well, to the extent that, I mean, the victim's still missing. This is the last known address that he's been seen at. Part of it is to protect the destruction of evidence. That is part of it. And some of the evidence can be maybe there's blood stains on the walls, which there were, that can be cleaned up in the interim. Part of it is there are a baseball cap and there's small items that they're looking
cleaned up,
for.
Just so we're understanding your argument, cleaned up in the interim between knocking and what, 15 seconds or 20, 30 seconds, if they don't answer, you can go in anyway?
You're sure, if it's just drips of blood, they may just throw a carpet over it, a little rug over it or something, right? I mean, there are possible ways to hide it if they haven't done a thorough job yet. Right, but there's
you've got a search warrant. You're not limited to, I mean, the things that are named in the search warrant would allow you to pull up the rug.
But there's also the items of all these things, the shoes, the pants, the jacket, the necklace, the baseball cap, the cell phone, all of these things could easily be just in a garbage bag somewhere that they are able to run out the back door with it if they don't have a full surrounding of the house when they're executing this warrant.
That's all evidence. I mean, you can run out of the house with all evidence or potential evidence. I mean, what's the particularized basis to believe that these six items could be destroyed? How is this in compliance with Botello?
I mean, if you look at what the district court found here, these are items that could be easily hidden, removed, or destroyed prior to going in. We also have the idea that this is a person who was last seen at this address, and this person needs to be protected. Because as was asked, somebody's throat could be slit in the 15 to 20 seconds before as a police knock.
How do you destroy white baseball shoes in the 15 to 30 seconds that it takes between
It's more about being removed than it is being destroyed. Because I agree, you can't run that through. Unless you have an incinerator, which we used to have when I was growing up in the basement, where you can throw them in there. Absent that, it's pretty tough to remove it. So I agree with that, but there is more to it than just, there's multiple different things, including the evidence, including protection for police, including protection for, this victim.
Okay.
That
so
justifies
what,
the
what
no
is
knock.
It though, going back to Judge Frisch's question, I mean, you need more for a no knock. You can't just throw in there's evidence. It could be removed. There has to be something particular about the circumstance of the case that raises the additional concern justifying the no-knock. For example, you know that this individual is known to have firearms or has threatened law enforcement officers. When it comes to the evidence, destruction or removal, what is the particularized basis for that justification for the no-knock? Forget about the protection of the victim. Just focusing on the evidence removal, what is it in the affidavit that would suggest that the officer had some particularized concern about the evidence in this case?
So the reasonable suspicion here, is a suspicion reasonable to think that that evidence might be removed or somehow destroyed?
That's not what I'm asking.
And what we have here, that's the standard of a no-knock.
Hold on a second. That's not what I'm asking you. Let's agree that it's reasonable. I'm asking you whether there's a particularized circumstance in this case that the officer articulated in the application. I think that's the standard. Beyond, I'm not just talking about whether it's reasonable. First, you've got to ask, what was it that the officer suggested other than boilerplate? So I'm asking you, what was it in this case?
When you look back at the rest of the warrant application, what you see is a crime that could be kidnapping, a crime that could be related to the dispute over a drug debt. All of these add to danger to the victim. And all of these add to especially with kidnapping, wanting to cover up that crime and wanting to make sure that nothing from this person is found in this house. And so that is the particularized information. And they were very specific of what they're looking for.
You're saying that we should draw the inference that the officer had a particularized concern, not that anything was articulated in the application.
I agree that in the application about asking for the unannounced entry, it's one paragraph on addendum on page 4 that is pretty pretty short. It appears to be one sentence.
Does the state concede that Hudson does not apply in Minnesota?
I mean, under Jackson, it seems like that is an open question where Hudson might apply because the result here wouldn't be to completely suppress the evidence. That issue wasn't briefed. I think to be fair to appellant's counsel that supplemental briefing may be warranted if the court wants to go down that road. But I think that is in
play. Well, it wasn't just appellant's counsel.
I didn't do it either.
Your brief also doesn't touch on the issue.
I didn't do it either, and that's my bad. I absolutely should have raised that issue.
I have one more question, Judge Ross, if I may.
Well, you certainly may.
It is unclear to me what happened when the search warrant was actually executed. When I look at Officer Coons's testimony, he says that he's at a safe distance while others are executing the warrant. Are you conceding, Mr. Schmidt, that this warrant was actually executed without an announced entry? Or do we not know that?
I don't know that.
So if we found, hypothetically, if we found that the warrant was supported by probable cause, but the no-knock provision of the warrant is invalid, would this need to be remanded for the district court to receive evidence as to the manner in which the warrant was executed?
I think it would.
All right, thank you.
Doesn't appear as if there are any other questions from the panel, so thank you, Mr. Schmidt. Counsel for appellant.
Yes, Your Honor, I just want to briefly touch upon your question about Hudson. I went back and looked at the Garza case, Your Honor, and that does touch upon the Leon good faith exception. And it does reject the Leon good faith exception rule. And that is at 639 and 640 of that decision. And
but I think Hudson was separate analysis from the Leon issue and good faith. It was simply the application of the suppression remedy for this type of violation, even acknowledging, as Justice Scalia did, that this is a constitutional violation that the Supreme Court said, we're not necessarily, we might in some cases, but it's not a per se rule that exclusion of evidence, suppression of evidence is the remedy.
And I would say to that point, Your Honor, that would go against the what Garza has set up here in that if good faith doesn't apply, why would other exceptions apply to the exclusionary rule?
Well, I mean, but except for the fact that the Supreme Court has expressly said, not with regard to good faith, but with regard to the overarching holding in Hudson, that the Supreme Court in Minnesota has not yet decided that question. Expressly said, we don't need to reach that issue in Jackson, so the court didn't. And so I don't think the court expressly saying we're not going to decide that issue can be glossed over by a case that doesn't mention Hudson and that doesn't deal with the issue of Hudson, deals with a separate issue, which is good faith.
And perhaps, Your Honor, in that case, this should be a published decision and that should try to trigger review from the Supreme Court if that's available. Your Honor, Judge Frisch, you were asking Mr. Schmidt at the end about the reasonable suspicion. And I'm sorry, I forgot exactly what your question was about that, but I did think I had a point about it, if you don't mind repeating.
And I was going to actually ask you about this as well, Ms. Workman. So it was unclear to me from the record as it currently exists whether the warrant was executed without an announcement. And Mr. Schmidt agreed that to develop that answer, we would need to remand the question to the district court. Do you agree with that?
I don't believe a remand is necessary here for two reasons. First, I believe there is some mention, I'm recalling vaguely from one of the Bloomington police report records from a police officer saying when the warrant was executed as a no-knock warrant. I could be misrecalling that, but I believe there is some mention somewhere about that.
There is a mention, but it's very vague and it didn't seem to be from someone who actually executed the warrant. So, I'm just wondering if there was a reappraisal at the time of the execution.
Second, I don't think that there was a reappraisal, but I don't believe a remand is necessary here because when you authorize a no-knock warrant based on information that doesn't rise to reasonable suspicion, that is an invalid warrant to begin with. It doesn't matter how it's executed, it's invalid to begin with.
Now, Mr. Schmidt brings up the point that the arguments as presented in the district court and here would allow us to consider, I don't want to put words in Mr. Schmidt's mouth, but I am paraphrasing, would allow us to consider not just the language in the affidavit or the application, but also all the information that came out at the hearing about the criminality of your client.
I respectfully disagree with that. When it comes to no-knock warrants, and perhaps this wasn't clear from the way that I briefed the case, when it comes to no-knock warrants, I believe it is evaluated the same as a probable cause standard would be evaluated, and that is based on the four corners of the application. And I just want to point out regarding probable cause that it's very important to remember that the officer here said he didn't have probable cause of any crime. There was no crime here that they thought had occurred. They're just looking for a missing person and they just want information about a missing person, which is not a crime. I understand that this is a tragedy, what happened to this victim, but we cannot parse this because this is a murder case and apply different constitutional standards. Your honors were going to reverse because this if this happened in a drug case or a firearms case, your honors should also reverse in this case because there's not a different standard here, regardless of the tragedy that occurred.
I have one question for Ms. Workman, Judge Ross.
Go ahead.
I just want to make sure I understand, Ms. Workman, it's reasonable suspicion and then the magistrate and or we could draw the reasonable inferences from the affidavit. Would that be a fair statement?
I would say yes, based on what is given to you in the affidavit. Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I concur with that. Yes.
Thank you very much.
And that gets us a bit beyond the four corners, unlike the probable cause determination. Yes?
As far as mental work is involved, yes, I agree. Yes.
Well, we'll try not to do any of that.
We've been accused of not doing that. Well, counsel, thank you both for your arguments. The matter is submitted. Thank you for your oral arguments. Thank you for your briefing. Very nice job by both of you. We appreciate the thoroughness. Sorry to throw a boomerang in there about Hudson, but you can both be happy that neither of you saw that one coming. So we appreciate it. We'll issue the opinion within the statutory period. The matter is submitted and therefore we are in recess until we reconvene for our live argument. Thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you.